Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the textbook duo today, with a focus on two countries on the Indian subcontinent. Naomi Hossain will explain what's been going on in Bangladesh, where a popular uprising deposed a tyrannical prime minister, and Sandipto Dasgupta will talk about the invention of the Indian nation through a study of its constitution writing. In early July, mass protests against Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina broke out, which the government responded to brutally, shooting down demonstrators in the street, killing 200 and injuring 20,000. The immediate cause of the protest was a quota system for government jobs that favored descendants of those who fought in the country's War of Independence, but as we'll hear, there are many more grievances against her rule. That War of Independence was sparked by a massive genocidal attack by West Pakistan, now Pakistan, on the Bengali separatists in East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, in 1971. The separatists were driven by anger at West Pakistan's discrimination against those in the East. The West Pakistani army, in conjunction with a militia known as the Razakars, killed between 300,000 and 3 million Bengalis in an attempt to suppress the rebellion. The U.S., under the expert guidance of Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, supported the genocidaires because they regarded West Pakistan as a Cold War ally and a conduit to improving relations with China. Here to explain the protests is Naomi Hossain, a professor in the Development Studies Department at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. For the second week in a row, we're treated to some canine background vocals. I did my best to take out the barking, but at the expense of partially garbling Naomi's speech. Naomi Hossain. The spark for this uprising was a quota system for allocating government jobs. But I'm sure there are some accumulating tensions behind that. What was the political environment that led up to this social explosion?
The political environment was one of increasing authoritarianism for at least 10 years and possibly most of the 15 years that the Sheikh Hasina regime was in power. And that had meant an increasing number of efforts to silence civil society and the media, to suppress the opposition, and most sinister, I think, a whole campaign of forced disappearances of people who were seen as critical or dangerous to the regime's power. They were picked up by the secret police and other groups and either disappeared permanently or for some days, and in some cases returned. Some were kept in a prison known as Ainaghor, which means the House of Mirrors, and tortured, and some were kept there for years and years. Only just been let out. So it was a political situation in which there was also a growing sense of an economic crisis. There was a cost of living crisis after the Ukrainian war started, when energy prices all around the world went up. And people were really struggling with that. But we just had an election of sorts in January of 2024. And so it was very clear, because the Sheikh Hasina regime rigged that election so thoroughly, that there was no way you could even change your government in Bangladesh. So all of these were at work when the students took to the streets.
What was her background, political background, and how did she turn into this sort of hard-assed authoritarian figure?
Hard-assed, yes. So a very interesting and also very sad personal biography Sheikh Hasina had, which is she is the daughter of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, whom we know as Bangabandhu, friend of the Bengalis, who was the leader of the National Liberation War back in 1971 and brought the country to independence. It used to be the eastern wing of Pakistan until that time, after the partition from India. He brought Bangladesh to national independence. It was quite a bloody war, and basically nobody except India came in on Bangladesh's side. And he was regarded, at least to begin with, as a national hero. But he was then murdered 49 years ago in August 1975. With the rest of her entire family, her mother, her younger brother, in-laws, other people from the family, everyone except Sheikh Hasina and her sister Rehana were murdered. Then she was in exile for many years and eventually came back to power, first as prime minister in 1996 under a multi-party electoral system. And then as the second time she came to power was again a landslide victory in 2009. And since then, she had ruled until she left on August the 5th.
Who led the protests? What was the age and social profile of the people in the streets?
Well, very much it was a, what they say, a Gen Z protest movement. It was very much young people who had never actually, we should be clear, never actually had a chance to vote really in their country's elections, because they would have been in their 20s and maybe early 30s, but most of them students from the public universities and the private universities. You know, it's a very large country. Bangladesh is the eighth biggest nation in the world. I don't know if people know that. 170 odd million people in Bangladesh. And about 30 million are aged between 15 and 30. So the students came to the streets because they were arguing against a reservation system in the civil service recruitment system. Now, this sounds, I think, to American ears like an anti-affirmative action protest, but it's not that exactly. The affirmative action in this case was intended essentially for the grandchildren, the families of people who had fought in the Liberation War and who were basically in some ways seen as political favorites of the regime. Nobody really thought that this system was viable or valid. 33% of the seats of the jobs in government service were earmarked for these people under this system. It was a stupid system. Nobody thought it should exist. Even the government didn't want it to last. The government had supported having it removed, which is what the students wanted. The fact is that it all escalated when the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, made a very sarcastic comment. I think the most politically costly sarcastic comment anyone ever made, which is when she said that if these jobs should not go to the families of Liberation War heroes, freedom fighters, as we call them, then should they go to the families of traitors? Razakars was the word she used specifically. Razakar.
Now, that's a very loaded word in Bangladesh, right?
Yes, Razakar is a very loaded word. It means the people who collaborated with the Pakistanis back in 1971 and now are seen as war criminals in various ways. And so this was a huge insult. You know, these young people are very patriotic. Many of them wanted a decent job with prospects, but many of them also really wanted a chance to serve their country. I meet a lot of young people in my job in Bangladesh and elsewhere. I work with a lot of young researchers and students and others, and they're deeply patriotic people. They're really proud of how far their country has come. Many of them want to bring their skills to government. It was just a really, you know, outrageous statement, and that's really when it started to kick off, and the Awami League government sent in their, they call them a student wing, but they're basically a bunch of thugs, almost like a criminal gang. And they sent them in, they beat up the students. Then they sent in the police and finally even the army. And at this point, the whole protest went away. You know, it moved on, rather, I should say, from being about reservations for jobs in civil service to being very much about the need for regime change, the fact that this was an illegitimate government, shooting people point blank in the streets.
What about the economic situation? Are things pretty bad? In the West, we know Bangladesh is mostly a garment producer, but I'm sure things are more complicated than that. So what is the economic background to this protest?
So it's not much more complicated than garments, actually. The two main exports of Bangladesh are garments and labor. We send a lot of people abroad, in particular to the Middle East and Southeast Asia, for work, relatively low-skilled on the whole. So that and ready-made garments are the big exports. It's a very agrarian nation still, even though it's the most densely populated large country in the world. Agro-processing, agriculture in general is a really big industry. Other industries are growing as well, like manufacturing, tech, and so on. But we have been very dependent, overly dependent on the garments industry. It's something that people have been worried about for many years. We saw in COVID when people stopped buying so many clothes and the big clothing companies, you know, the Gaps and the others, decided they didn't need any new clothes. Bangladesh's economy really struggled at that precise moment. But Bangladesh has been growing. You know, it's people remember, I think in the US especially, people of a certain generation remember Henry Kissinger describing it as the basket case. This reputation has long not been deserved. It's been one of the fastest growing economies in the world for many, many years, very high growth rates, averaging around 6% per year in Sheikh Hasina's tenure, although there are people who say these numbers may not be entirely accurate. I don't see any good reason to doubt them yet. There's been a lot of infrastructural development. The city of Dhaka, but the rest of the country too, really has been transformed since I was a kid in the 70s and the 80s. So it's growing very fast. People have been, you know, moving out of poverty very fast. There's a lot of aspiration, but there's also been a lot of corruption and crony capitalism, as we call it, during Sheikh Hasina's period of rule. And that has really destabilized the economy in a number of ways. There's been a lot of borrowing to build these fancy big bridges and roads that we were all marveling at. But also massive loans have been given to cronies of the government, and now the banking sector is looking a bit wobbly, shall we say. The government has gone to the IMF for loans and is asking, I think, for further bailouts. And right now we have the most massive floods we have seen in decades. So all of this is not looking like a very good situation. That said, we've had really bad economic situations in the past and pulled through. It's an incredibly resilient population in Bangladesh.
Have there been efforts to diversify the economy? What's policy look like?
There have been efforts, but there's been a lot of investment in garments. A lot of people know how to do it. Government-led diversification efforts have not been very effective, and it's partly because I think it's reasonably well known that as people occupy many positions of power in parliament, elsewhere in the political system, and don't really see any need to invest in other sectors. But there have been, you know, there's leather, there's fisheries, jute, which is historically what they produced in Bangladesh, which is the main export earnings under the British, and subsequently has also made a comeback. There are growth sectors. I mean, it may sound like a poor place, but actually it's a big economy just by virtue of the large population. The domestic economy itself is very large.
Was there an organization behind this? Political parties, any kinds of other organizations, or is it mostly a spontaneous thing?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, I study protests, not just in Bangladesh. And, you know, usually when you look closely at what actually happened and who was actually involved, you'll find that some organized group, whether it's organized labor or opposition parties and coalitions, are present in uprising like this. And yet, it does not seem to be the case here. It does seem to have been a pretty spontaneous uprising by students. The students themselves are pretty well organized, though. They have something called the Students Against Discrimination Movement. They have been quite thoughtful. They think, they read, they organize, they plan, they have committees to deal with various aspects of governance and politics. And they're playing something of a role now, I think you probably know, in the current interim government. No outside forces, as far as we can see, have been involved, despite all the conspiracy theories that...
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. There have been conspiracy theories that it was something related to the US or China or God knows what, but no.
Everyone has been fingered as having been involved in some way, but the evidence strongly suggests this was an indigenous uprising by students with an initial genuine grievance and then much broader grievance about the governance, the political governance of the country, about the lack of democracy, essentially. So when all is said and done, when all of the evidence comes out, I'd be very surprised if we see any evidence that anyone else was behind this.
I'm speaking with Naomi Hossain, Professor of Development Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, London. She's out, and now there's a caretaker regime led by Mohamed Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank, highly regarded by the World Bank and the financial markets. What do you expect from him? Is this just a temporary transitional regime, or what are we likely to see?
Yes, it is an interim government. It is a temporary situation. The interim government under Professor Yunus is tasked with bringing Bangladesh back to multi-party democracy, to elections, free and fair elections. But in order to do that, it needs to do some other things too first. It needs to undertake certain reforms, institutions like the Election Commission, the Anti-Corruption Commission, try to encourage political parties to behave themselves better, to look at the regulations regarding police and some of the courts as well. There's a bunch of different things that they're planning to do in that area. Other people, though, are saying that actually they need to go a bit further. And I'll tell you why. Because we actually have already had an experiment of this kind. In 2007, 2008, there was an army-backed, non-party caretaker government that stayed for 2 years and undertook a bunch of different reforms of this kind. That was a different political situation. That military-backed caretaker government took over from the BNP, which is the main opposition party in Bangladesh, which had also been trying to rig the elections. The Awami League at that time was in the opposition. But that caretaker government did a lot of really good things. For 2 years, it was a very well-governed place, although there weren't many civil rights. This politics was being reformed. A lot of politicians were thrown in jail. There was a lot of anti-corruption rooting out corrupt practices in various institutions. But actually, that was when we had these wonderful free and fair elections and Sheikh Hasina came to power in 2009, dominated ever since, got increasingly powerful after that. So it's clear that whatever those reforms did, they didn't stick, or at least not in the way they needed to. Some people say it even made things worse.
Was there an angle of Hindu-Muslim tensions? Does this figure in the story at all?
There is certainly an angle. There were some, I don't know about Hindu-Muslim tensions within Bangladesh. There were some attacks on Hindu and other minorities, in fact, in Bangladesh, after Sheikh Hasina fell. And the reason for that seems to be that religious minorities really are seen as aligned with the Awami League as opposed to the opposition party, the BNP, which is seen as more closely aligned to Islamism and the use of Islam as a state religion and so on. There has been, though, it is really difficult to say for sure what happened in that week after Sheikh Hasina resigned, because there's been this absolute flood of disinformation. There was a flood of disinformation from India, as far as we can tell, but also to some extent from the Awami League. I have seen credible reports that up to something like 200 attacks did occur against minorities, including other minority Muslim groups and other groups, not just Hindus. But the flood of disinformation has made it very difficult to make sense, actually, of what happened. It seems that the most well-documented cases were cases in which Awami League leaders and followers who were Hindu were targeted. And in some cases, actually, it does seem to be the Awami League followers who have been targeting Hindu targets for reasons that they would like to show that the regime is unstable and anti-Hindu and so on. But it's been a very difficult situation to make sense of. I spoke with a leading human rights defender, and she said they've had very limited information. I don't think that there has been this epidemic of violence against Hindus at all. This is greatly overstated, but it's worrying nonetheless. It's worrying both that these things can happen and worrying also that we can find the facts so obscured by massive amounts of disinformation that the truth finally becomes almost impossible to know.
And finally, is this movement coherent enough, organized enough to have longer term demands or strategies, or will it fade now that the government is gone?
No, I think it is organized, and I think it is having a role in this interim government. Two of the student leaders are in the interim government cabinet itself. They are being courted by the political parties, by civil society and the media. They have ideas, which are new ideas, I believe. There is some talk about other kinds of political reforms, which will really shift power away from the traditional sites of power, the parties, the parliament and, key state institutions, much more towards the people. I think that it's been a real political education for an entire generation in Bangladesh, which had no political education. It had been taboo to talk really about politics. It had been dangerous to talk about politics, to have any political opinions. People didn't for many years. And so it has brought an entire generation into politics. Young people believe that they rightly believe that it was their revolution. They got rid of a dictator who had been in power for many years, who had the army on her side, the police, the Indian government on her side. She had all of these forces of power on her side, and yet the students and their supporters in the wider society, I should say, they did have a lot of support in wider society, particularly after the government started shooting people in the streets. I think they will. I think we've got to look at what examples there are for a student movement to move more firmly into politics. But there is a real appetite, I would say, for them to do so, because many people not only don't like the Awami League, they also not very interested in either the BNP or the Jamaat Islami, who are the main opposition parties, the Jatiya Party. There's these four of them. None of them are very well loved by Gen Z, I would say.
That was Naomi Hossain, a professor of the Development Studies Department at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of Franz Schubert's Piano Sonata D959, first movement, performed by Alfred Brendel. Next, a historical look at Bangladesh's much larger neighbor, the one that gives the name to the subcontinent, India. Sandipto Dasgupta, an assistant professor of politics at the New School for Social Research, is just out with a book, Legalizing the Revolution, India and the Constitution of the Post-Colony, published by Cambridge University Press. It's a study of how a colony became an independent nation and the role of constitution writing in that process. Sandipto Dasgupta. The first thing one notices about the Indian constitution is its massive size. It's, 136,000 words, the table of contents of 30 pages, 18 times the size of the U.S. constitution. How did it get to be so long?
You're right. This is the first thing people notice about the constitution. And the reason is, I think it's somewhat quite simple, which is that the Indian Constitution derives a lot from the colonial constitutional acts. The British used to have these constitutional acts, which were detailed administrative document for what were like these massive colonial state apparatus, right? So to do with bureaucratic appointments, you know, apportionment of revenue, army, and so on. And when the post-colonial rulers took over, and this is, I think, the interesting part here, which is that they didn't really remake the state. They kept the colonial state apparatus, including the personnel in many cases, intact. And because they did that, they also kept the manual for that apparatus, so to speak, intact, right? So about two-thirds of the Indian constitution is almost a direct copy of the last colonial constitutional acts. And that sort of explains why it has this sort of, you know, very, very detailed administrative quality to it.
So the preamble, we the people of India, and these few words present several questions all at once. Who is this we and who are the people and how do they constitute each other?
I think this is sort of at the heart, which is, for me, this is really the heart of the tension of the constitution-making project. Because on the one hand, India does actually have a mass mobilizational anti-colonial movement. This is not sort of one of those kind of, you know, intra-elite transfer of power situations. They're actually, Congress, by any measure, was the largest mass party in history by membership, offices, and organization. And they do have a mass popular movement. So they actually invoke this idea of, you know, people or popular sovereignty as the center of their claim for freedom from British colonial rule. But on the other hand, you know, sort of these mass movements tend to sort of radicalize themselves far beyond what the leaders imagine. And this is exactly what happens in India, especially sort of the leading up, you know, post sort of Great Depression, but really leading up the last decade of independence. You get mobilizations among peasantry, among labor, students, which are often making far more radical demands than what sort of the Indian National Congress is willing. It takes it to a much more sort of revolutionary direction. They have this interesting situation where there's, on the one hand, there is this, you know, dependence on this idea of the people, or Congress's claim to power is based on their popular support. But on the other hand, they have this real deep anxiety of actual popular politics. And you see this tension entirely in the constitutions. You have these sort of, you know, very broad democratic sort of provisions, like in universal franchise. You have it right away, not sort of stage-wise, you have in the Western countries. On the other hand, you have several provisions which allows the state to have major repressive powers, you know, which curtail some forms of political participation or political expression. And I think this tension between, you know, both this idea of the people which they evoke versus the people as they exist outside the Constituent Assembly is very much tension. I think this is not just an Indian situation. This is very much across the post-colonial world, because there is this, you know, major gap between the urban elite bourgeoisie, who are often the leaders of these anti-colonial movements, and this sort of vast peasant masses, which sort of constitute the populace of these countries, right? And there is often a gap, both in terms of language, both in terms of ideals and aspirations between these groups. And that really shows up, I think, in the constitution.
How is the constitution writing body chosen?
So, you know, that's another very interesting, important point, because Congress demanded all through the colonial era that it should be chosen on basis of an universal adult franchise election. So they demanded elected Constituent Assembly, which will then write a constitution. That's not what happened. What you actually get is sort of, you know, a Constituent Assembly which draws from the last sort of colonial era elections, where roughly about 9 to 10% of Indians were eligible to vote. And it's sort of then there is kind of indirect election from those assemblies, which gives us the Constituent Assembly. So Congress kind of, you know, going back to this sort of tension amongst, you know, between sort of popular politics and, you know, idea of the people, Congress sort of, you know, goes back on its own idea of an elected assembly. So you have kind of a semi-selected assembly, and then, you know, in more than de facto level, it's really Congress chooses the members. You have more or less all sections except the communists and the socialists in the assembly. So you have anything sort of, you know, the right of like socialist all the way up to sort of the Hindu nationalist in the assembly. So they are quite diverse, but it's sort of more or less selected by the Congress.
The preamble continues to talk about equality, fraternity, assuring the dignity of the individual and the integrity of the nation. Some of that reads pretty oddly in the era of Narendra Modi and rule by the BJP. How is the Constitution seen in the light of this kind of regime?
So there are two parts to it. You know, one part is that while they don't always sort of say it, but they have come very close. And as the, by they, I mean the sort of the Hindu nationalist right in India, the Modi government, but also a larger sort of, you know, social intellectual milieu that they have, is that they do think that they want to sort of reconstitute India as what they call a Hindu Rashtra or a Hindu state. And that would really mean a different constitution. And they really see themselves in that sense as sort of this anti-Congress, right? They see themselves as embodying the new kind of national politics of India, which is not based on this kind of more or less secular anti-colonial politics of Congress, right? This is why, for example, Modi has this really personal animus against Nehru. And that's the kind of figure they're going against. They have a rather big ambition there. So they have, many of the intellectuals have written books about what would their constitutional vision be, why this constitution is not good. But politically, I think they have faced a challenge. And especially this last election, the opposition really made the constitution kind of a rallying point and sort of saving the constitution. And, you know, they carried the constitutions in their hands. They, you know, they showed up everywhere to have to protect the constitution. And facing that, I think the BJP kind of sort of was more or less, no, we don't want to touch the constitution. So there's sort of two sides. I think the aspiration is very much to have a new kind of constitutional founding for India. But they know that they don't really have the political ability yet, it seems, after this election.
Congress, the Congress Party, a remarkable institution, founded almost 140 years ago. It's not what it once was, but it's still a power in India. And it was so dominant for a century or more. How did it come to be? How did it achieve this status and longevity?
So this is, again, there's two parts. So first is the as the anti-colonial part. So it sort of Congress starts off as a pretty small organization of the urban liberal elites in the late 19th century. So these are like the lawyers, the professionals, educators, you know, who have kind of a very limited sort of liberal demand for the British state. And it really shifts after the First World War. And this is, again, across the colonial world, because the First World War sort of mobilized a lot of resources and men, and that there is a kind of a radicalizing element to that. And you have the beginning of these mass movements. And Congress, especially under the leadership of Gandhi, transforms itself from this sort of small petitioning society into this large mass movement with organization, which basically, you know, mirrored the British state. So they had an office, party office, every, like the lowest administrative level, right? So kind of this enormous organizational level. It became, again, very typical sort of anti-colonial party, which cuts across class lines. It sort of unites both the nascent Indian bourgeoisie along with the peasantry and this one umbrella around the question of nationalism. And then, again, like many of its peers across the colonial world, it sort of transforms itself in the last sort of, you know, 10 to 5 years of the colonial rule into a party of government to be, government in waiting. So it's sort of transformed itself from the party of anti-colonial movement to the party of the post-colonial governance. And it has these visions, again, very common ones across the 1950s, of a big developmentalist state, you know, kind of this one party which has this model of creating consensus amongst several different classes, especially the elite groups, and having this kind of more or less more technocratic, you know, five-year plans and development planning with a kind of a very strong nationalist tension. This kind of model begins to fracture from the 1970s onwards, where, you know, the kind of dissatisfaction with the state-led developmentalist idea of decolonization, it's not transformative enough, you know, it doesn't really transform the power relations in the society enough. And that leads to challenge to the Congress's hegemony in Indian politics from the 70s onwards and starting kind of a much more fracturing across regional lines, caste lines in India. And Congress sort of, you know, loses the complete dominance it had on the Indian political scene from then onwards. which now they have more or less ceded to the BJP, which is sort of a Hindu nationalist party in contrast to the Congress.
The elites that really constituted the constitution writing exercise were formed in relation to British rule. They were very much their subordinates, local agents, and their consciousness and practice was all about administering a colonial state. How did they come to transform themselves into a national elite?
But the question people ask is to what extent they did transform themselves fully, right, in terms of their consciousness and the more the instruments and tools of governance they draw upon. But one thing which you can see across the colonial world is sort of, you know, roughly post-First World War, but really after the Great Depression, you see like a fracture between the nascent bourgeoisie in the colonies and the metropole, and their interests no longer really ally. And initially, sort of these kind of elites, these bourgeois elites, but also like the professional elites were really at the forefront, journalists and lawyers primarily. What they wanted was kind of a much more of a liberal reform of the colonies, a bit more rights, some more representation, less sort of racist discrimination. But that really transforms into, by the 30s, into claim for national sovereignty. And I think there is this sort of, both the maturing of the bourgeoisie in these regions and also kind of, they're building on this sort of mass popular support, which also pushes their demand much further than they were willing to go in the 1910s or 20s, let's say. By the early to mid-30s at different parts of the colonial world, you now see a new sort of national bourgeoisie or national elite emerging, which wants a complete break with the imperial order and want national sovereignty. And that's sort of the trend you see across the colonial world.
Indian independence was remarkable in that there was an uprising for decades before the British finally let go. But there was no actual violent revolution. But then the constitution writers, the Indian elite, were concerned that there might be. So what about this specter of revolution that didn't happen but might? How did that figure into the process?
Precisely because it didn't happen is why they fear it might happen, right? So I think they have what the term which people have often used, sort of, drawing from Gramsci, the idea of a revolution without a revolution, which is what happens in many of these colonies, definitely in India, which is that you have a pretty massive transformation from an imperial, the world's like most powerful imperial state, the British Indian government, to this really kind of popular national government, right? So that's a significant, massive political shift. But it is not accompanied by any kind of what you will call sort of a revolutionary upheaval. If you want to say like, major changes in society, changes in forms and meanings, the way you kind of imagine revolutions, let's say in a French or Russian revolution context, right? So you kind of have this huge change, but you don't have a major shift in the social condition. And so that's what they worry about, is that now you have this situation where earlier there was a kind of common unified front against the British rule. That's no longer the case. And now many of the social sort of disgruntlement, but actually more than disgruntlement, animus, let's say, will turn towards the local elites, right? Among for the peasantry, for the workers and so on. And so they realize that if they just let things be the way they are, there's going to be, major social unrest to deal with. Nehru has this line where he says, basically, either we do a revolution in here on our terms, by which he means like a developmental planning, plan transformation, or it will happen out there without any sort of influence by us. So precisely because they didn't really have that kind of transformation during the first process of transition is why they think they need to kind of get ahead of the social unrest and do some level of social transformation.
And they plunged right into a universal franchise. They didn't limit it. Remarkable transformation for a country that had been a colony for so long. Why did they decide that and how did it work out?
So I think that's really is a remarkable thing. You're right. And if you think about like the Western democracies, it takes about roughly a century or more to go from elections to for universal franchise, right? And here you do it right away in a country where, the vast mass is still there at that time, were not illiterate, deeply poor, so, questions of, worries about property and so on. Despite all of that, so you have it right away. I think the answer is pretty simple. The answer that I was saying earlier, which is that it was the popular movement. And anti-colonial movements were really at the heart of it, a movement for democracy. That's the core demand, which is something the empire can't give you. And that was at the heart of it, the idea that Indians can govern themselves. And that was the basis of Congress's claim to power. Now, how do you then turn around and say, okay, but there are these all these, portions of the Indians who are not actually have the capacity to be participant in democracy? Precisely your argument has been all this while that, you know, they can. And not just the argument, you know, rhetorically, but also organizationally. You were a mass party. You kind of, you had this mass membership, which includes the peasantry. How do you suddenly tell them that, no, you know, by the way, you can't actually vote? So any of the sort of classic things you think of in the Western democracies, which serve as a barrier to franchising, gender or race or property ownership, class, education, none of those things really, therefore, you know, come into play, really possible. And they, you know, and they realize it's a very, very radical move to do. It's a daunting thing. And they have some degree of anxiety about that. But there's really no other way of doing that. What decolonization did is it's really kind of universalized the principle of popular sovereignty and universal franchise, right? And that's kind of, it made it a global phenomenon.
I'm speaking with Sandipta Dasgupta, author of Legalizing the Revolution, India and the Constitution of the Post-Colony, just out from Cambridge University Press. The idea of India, India as a country was the invention of the British. They drew the borders. This was a very heterogeneous population, languages, religions, ethnicities. I'm sure we could talk for hours about this. But how did India come to conceive of itself as a unitary country? What was that process like?
So you're right. I think it is. I mean, India still is. It's really a continent, much more similar to Europe than to France. And I think it was constituted together under what you said, first by the British administrative unity, and then the political movement, which sort of mirrored that, right? So because it was a British state, that's where the anti-colonial movement started and gave that administrative sort of territory a political life. So it was not just a British creation in that sense. The anti-colonial movement really made it into a coherent political whole. And, you know, Congress, as I said, had a presence across the country, across different regions. It sort of created, you know, kind of a national leadership out of that, representing the different regions and different regional elites. And that sort of really made the country thinkable as a unit. But then, of course, there was the partition on religious lines. But before that, that's really what made India thinkable, I think, is this sort of, you know, national level political movement lasting about, you know, several decades.
Let's talk some about property. Under British rule, there wasn't much of an industrial bourgeoisie. The Brits did what they could to destroy what there was. And it was largely agricultural landlords, right? So how did that transform with independence?
So there was some industrial bourgeoisie. And that really is, again, First World War is an important story here, right? The disruptions in sort of the supply chain made the British realize that they needed some industrial base, not a lot, but some in the colonies. So there was sort of, you know, a nascent Indian bourgeoisie, especially in, you know, in the western part of the country, Bombay, Gujarat, but really a weak bourgeoisie, right? And one which was very dependent on the state, the colonial state and then the post-colonial state. But there was some. And so the idea was, you know, it's just sort of the, what you can call sort of the late development paradox, right? So there are kind of, this is a third wave. The model which was across the world, people at that time subscribed to was, you know, a sort of a state-led planned development project with sort of, you know, protectionist idea. The state invests heavily in primary goods, which are you don't have enough private capital for that, something like, you know, electricity and steel. And then you have private capital takeover in this, you know, the more sort of smaller sectors, right? It's consumer goods and things like that. That was called the mixed economy model, which again, this post-Keynesian, a particular third world variant of that. And that's what really India followed. India was slightly better off than many other colonies because it had a slightly stronger bourgeoisie. It also had a slightly stronger state because the British states that they invested in India because it was important for them. So it did slightly better than its peers in the beginning, but, you know, it ran into similar problems that most of these, you know, countries, you have different names for that, right? Middle income trap and so on, that you can't really grow beyond a particular point. And the other thing I think is important to know in India as well, which is that there's two important reasons why they couldn't go beyond a certain point in this realization after independence. One is they couldn't really destroy the older, more regressive social powers, the landlords especially. And that's, I think, a very important element of any kind of modernization or industrialization, to destroy that those pieces of social power. And India, they couldn't really. And the second thing is that they couldn't really also discipline their own bourgeoisie. And this is, again, a good comparison to something like, you know, Japan or South Korea, where you kind of tell the bourgeoisie, okay, I will give you protectionism, I'll give you this support, but you have to make a huge investment, let's say, in R&D, you have to be sort of export competitive, and you just can't just make easy kind of, you know, rent-seeking behavior in a protectionist economy. And the Indian state couldn't do that either, right? And it's partly this issue of being a democracy and, you know, having maintained a coalitional model. So both the inability to sort of, you know, deal with the landlords and the inability to discipline the capitalists enough to force them to sort of invest and innovate, both of those had a negative impact on India's sort of, you know, industrial development after independence.
Development strategy just after independence was very planning-oriented, very state-led. You quote Nehru saying the Soviets put magic into the word planning, but it was not a socialist idea. It was a state-led capitalism, right? Talk about that planning process and what the strategy and was and how it worked out.
Yes, I think the first thing your audience would know this, but you know, the idea of planning, which today we often sort of associate with sort of socialism and so on, were actually quite universal. You have stuff like the Marshall Plan. The idea of planning was not really limited to, you know, socialist countries at the time. Pretty much every single newly decolonized country had a version of the five-year plan. And the Soviets were quite proud of this idea that they exported this model. However, it was not socialist. There was never really a notion of sort of, you know, socializing the means of production. The idea of kind of some kind of distributional equality was never at the center of this. The idea, the point was that, you know, we have really, because of colonial rule, suffered and, you know, couldn't really develop enough because of distortions of colonial rule. And so we have to kind of do a catch-up development, but capitalist development, right? So sort of, you know, build up our infrastructure, build up our sort of a capital base. Local bourgeoisie is really weak enough. Local capital is weak enough. It's not enough of private capital. So the state has to borrow to invest. But all of this really is to create, you know, some kind of a capitalist economy, right? So there are some egalitarian goals attached to that. You know, there are some forms of, you know, labor reform. There's some form of kind of public ownership, which are there and which are important, but not to undervalue that. But at the heart of it, it's really not about creating a socialist economy, even if the word is often used very, very liberally across the third world. Everybody is a version of socialist, right? But there's never really an idea of kind of, you know, socializing the means of production or eliminating capitalism, any of those things. It's really about creating a capitalist economy from a point of disadvantage.
And the idea from the first was to build the productive capacity of the Indian economy and then maybe worry about redistribution later, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a two-stage process.
Somehow the second stage never arrives though, right?
Never comes, exactly. And it's always, you know, they call it a promissory check. And let's say growth is, you know, it's the first thing, and then we can think about any kinds of, you know, and even in the constitution, some of these aspirational distributional stuff, you know, something like welfare provisions and so on, are all sort of put in this provision, which is not immediately kind of, you know, you can't really go to court and sue on the basis of them. They are sort of aspirations. At some point when we're able to, we can look at those things. And yeah, and they're very clear about that, the planning, and they always say, like, growth is really the first thing. I think the problem they kind of face is that they realize, and this is the kind of the, you know, the bind, which is that without some level of distributional equality, right, some equality of power basis, you can't really get growth. That's the kind of the landlord problem, right? If you can't eliminate some real entrenched forms of social power, you know, you can't really grow. You can't really modernize beyond a point.
Yeah, you mentioned Korea earlier. They smashed the landlord class and had a radical land reform, and it worked out very well for them. India never did that.
No, they wanted to. Land reform was a state policy goal. Every Indian state, Indian province basically had a land reform act, but they couldn't do it for these reasons, which is, I think, that landlords had pretty significant levels of local power basis, right? And landlords are not just, you know, property owners. They are, you know, local power holders of various different kinds. And to sort of break that, just using kind of the bureaucracy wasn't enough. You know, and also the landlords even made their power even stronger by becoming sort of electoral agents, right? So they could sort of deliver votes to the Congress because they could sort of gather using their local power basis in sort of electoral ends. So what you needed to do that is that counteract that with some kind of a popular mobilization or some kind of a party apparatus. And the two states in India which get some modicum of land reform, which is Kerala and West Bengal, that's exactly what happens. It's the Communist Party there, which sort of mobilizes its own apparatus against the local part of the landlords to make the law somewhat of reality. But in other places, you have these sweeping land reform laws, and they don't really get implemented at all or completely subverted in various ways. Because, you know, there's not really much of a counterpower of the landlords. And that's where something like a popular movement or a party would have been useful, which, you know, the constitution makers don't turn towards because of their anxiety about popular movements.
Those states, which are larger than many nations are, how do they fit into the power structure? How powerful are the states? How decentralized, federalized is the Indian system, and what is the relation to the central government?
This is, I think, a very interesting shift which happened in India over time, which is that, so India, I think, it's a federal model, but nothing even close to being as strong as it is in America, right? Where this, you know, the central model is really kind of powerful, the states have a lot of power. That's not the case in India. And it's partly because of, you know, the first 5-year plans of centralized planning, you need kind of, you know, a strong federal centralized setup, right? So there's a lot of, you know, centralization of power, which happens from the very beginning. You know, also the colonial state itself was quite centralized. So you kind of have that legacy as well. But the federalization in India comes much more politically. After the Congress hegemony sort of, you know, is exhausted by the mid-70s, politics becomes much more sort of federalized because you have the Indian states are organized on linguistic basis. And sort of you have these local elites create these sort of regional parties as the challenger to Congress. And so you kind of get this sort of de facto federalism because the, you know, sort of electoral map becomes so diverse and scattered across these different regional parties who then claim some level of autonomy and power, right? This was the case from, say, mid-70s to the 2010s or so, right? And then again, after the BJP, there has been again, you know, a tendency for pretty significant centralization in very different ways and a curtailment of federalism, right? So you sort of have this, you know, back and forth between those two things. But in terms of the legal architecture, it's quite centralized.
Okay, back to the, some of the structures of the government from the Constitution. They explicitly rejected the American model, the separation of powers and, you know, the balance of forces model. But also, you know, the U.S. has a strong presidential system, which they rejected because of the fear of autocracy. But what about the courts? Do they have any system of judicial review that we do here?
Yeah, they do. And I think they, you know, they actually, unlike in America, they actually make judicial review a part of the Constitution. The important point was for them was that if you think of this sort of gradual social transformation as a necessity, the idea was that project would be sort of helmed by the national government with the sort of help of experts and planners, not by judges. And that's, there's a lot of good reasons for that, which they kind of articulate. Courts are really bad venues for planning or for social transformational agendas, because it's often about one person versus one person. It sort of individualizes things. They don't have the necessary knowledge, skills, to things in terms of law rather than terms of sort of, you know, economics or other kind of necessary knowledge base for development planning. So for all of these reasons, they thought that the courts sort of should stay out of that business of social transformation, right? That should be left to discretion of the state with the aid of the experts and planners. And that's not what happens. Courts are pretty immediately, and this is with the Land Reform Act we were talking about earlier, the courts sort of, you know, immediately come in and start sort of holding this or that parts of transformational laws unconstitutional under judicial review. So you kind of have from the very beginning, from the very first year of the Constitution, actually, this tension between the courts and this developmental planning state. And that sort of has a very important sort of legacy throughout in Indian history. But the interesting thing to remember there, I think, is that some of the debates you hear in America about, you know, why courts are not particularly a friendly venue for progressive or transformational agenda. The Indian constitution makers are much more aware of that because they kind of see America, they see the Lochner era American courts.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the constitution writers talked to Felix Frankfurter, who said, watch that stuff, right?
Absolutely. And that's what Frankfurter tells him, like, make sure the courts are out of this. And yeah, so I think they're quite self-aware of that, but they fail to do it nevertheless, because, you know, the courts find a way, as lawyers often do, to get involved to the detriment of the transformational project.
I guess we should start summing up here. The Constitution had dual tasks: to create political stability within a broadly democratic structure and also foster social and economic development. How have these things turned out? Have they managed that balance? And would the drafters be proud of the results?
I'm tempted to say not very well. But I think we should acknowledge that there has been quite remarkable levels of degree of political stability of the democratic system in India. And, you know, and above average levels of economic growth and distribution, even beyond the last sort of 10, 15 years when you have a much higher growth rate. It was sort of above average amongst its peers, right? So those should be noted. But I think the important point to mention is, I think one thing is that, you know, it fails, I think, for me in two important ways, right? One, I think there is a lesson here that even for a liberal constitutional system to take root, you needed to have quite an ambitious transformation of society, which is not necessarily possible within a liberal constitutional framework. So that's sort of an interesting irony, right? Like, I think they kind of realize that you really can't have a liberal constitutional system take root in a society which is this hierarchical or this unequal. And so I think that's the one level where they don't, and they kind of realize that they want to kind of, you know, change that, and they don't really able to do that. And the second thing, I think, interesting lesson here is in terms of social transformational plans. Again, this, I think, goes beyond India, is that you realize that even the best sort of, you know, planners and economic minds, which India did have, and they draw from, you know, great sort of, you know, people like Michael Galecki or Gunnar Myrdal, that's not enough if you don't have some kind of a popular movement, you know, on the ground to sort of carry it through. In some ways, again, the second irony is that they think they can do sort of this, you know, transformation, development transformation without the popular politics, through just purely sort of technocratic, expert-driven knowledge. And they realize that can't be done. You need some level of, you know, popular radicalizing politics to get even some of the technocratic plans to get through. And many of the planners in India kind of sort of see that by the end of it. One of them said, we should something look at what China has, kind of a cadre-based party. If we had that, maybe we could have done more. So I think those are two kind of important lessons, I think, which are often missed in the post-colonial context.
Yeah, as you say at the end of the book, it's true that the state was the most capable institution for taking on the localized tyrannies of caste and property, but it first had to be emancipated from the control of caste and property. I guess what you're saying is that didn't really happen.
No. I think, and actually what happened was the reverse, which is, as I said earlier, like, democracy was narrowed down to just sort of elections and electoralism rather than a wider popular mobilization. And then, you know, as I said, landlords were quite good at delivering votes. And so even now in India, you have this, you know, older sort of princes or landlords who have been, you know, members of parliament for generations in the places they used to be princes and landlords in. Translate their sort of social power into electoral power. The state was kind of recolonized by social power rather than the other way around.
There was Sandeepto Dasgupta, assistant professor of politics at the New School for Social Research and author of Legalizing the Revolution, India and the Constitution of the Post-Colony, just out from Cambridge University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, for no reason other than it's very beautiful, some more from Schubert's Piano Sonata D959, this from the second movement, performed again by Alfred Brendel. Till next week, bye.